Welcome back, everyone. I'm excited to introduce you to Cristobal Ramon. He's a migration policy expert. Well, this week, President Biden announced a new policy to deal with the continuing surge of migrants appearing at our southern border with Mexico. The initiative will expand Title 42 expulsion provisions started under the Trump administration, but also provide a parole system to eligible migrants from select countries in the Caribbean and or the Caribbean and Latin America. Now, the announcement left many frustrated on both sides of the immigration debate. So where does that leave the country when it comes to comprehensive reform? Well, let's find out. Cristobal Ramon is joining us, and he joins us on the John Schuster Caldwell Banker Hotline. Hello, sir, and welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. Glad to be on.
I'm glad that you're on. Let me tell you something. This has been discussed for so many decades that it's really frustrating to so many Americans. As you know, probably, many times we talk about immigration and it just goes to the wayside. We never seem to get it all done. Will we ever get it done?
I think, frankly, when you're looking at immigration and the long-term challenges, particularly when it comes to the border, we need to have a policy that's actually far more flexible. You hear a lot about people saying we need to fix the border permanently, but I think there's some real challenges that you see with the border, because if you saw, like, in the 1980s through the 1990s through the early 2000s, you had a lot of single Mexican men who were the majority of immigrants who were coming into the United States seeking work. And around 2014, we saw a pivot towards Central American families and unaccompanied children. And now we're seeing a new form of migration where you're seeing individuals coming from South America, traveling through Central America and up to the U.S.-Mexico border. And each of these different stages, I think, requires a different kind of immigration policy. And so I think the thing is, how can you have a flexible immigration policy for the border that can address and prepare us to address what's going to be changing? So much of the immigration debate around the border is just saying we're going to stop them from coming here. In reality, that really doesn't address the fact that people are coming for different reasons and they respond to different incentives. So, you know, there's a reason why it's hard to address the borders, because, you know, migration to the border has evolved over the last few decades. And you need to be thinking in terms of how is the best way to do this. And I think one thing to add on to this point, though, and I think it is good that we're seeing this in the hemispheres, countries in the Western Hemisphere need to assist the United States with managing migration to the U.S.-Mexico border and managing migration in the whole region. And I'm happy to talk about sort of how that's being done over the last year or so. But it's not just simply the United States' job to manage migration. I think the countries in the region really need to pitch in as well.
You know, you are a graduate of McAllister College, and of course, you were able to get your Master's of Arts in International Affairs program at the George Washington University's Elliott School of International Affairs. My question for you is that you've been watching this for a long time. You know exactly what is happening. You know when they are trying to tell us, we're going to do this, we're going to do this new thing, and it never seems to come to fruition. Here you were in school making sure that you fought for this. You wanted to know all about it. You wanted to help in some way when it comes to international affairs. Tell me where you're at now. Do you believe we will ever get to the point where it all makes sense to everyone, those that are coming, those that are leaving? And that's something I want to talk to you about, those that are leaving. And I'm not talking about those trying to get to their countries. I'm talking about Americans who are now talking about flight, right? Saying, hey, I'm just going to go. I'm not going to go to all these other countries that we're connected to. I'm going to go to Italy. I'm going to go to France, that sort of thing. So tell me if you have been pleased with the changes that we are seeing today when it comes to migration.
So I think at the hemispheric level, and first of all, thank you for acknowledging McAllister. I love my time there. Love Minnesota. I'm originally from Los Angeles, and Minnesota definitely made me feel at home, so I appreciated my time there. Awesome. But, you know, more seriously, you know, I think the thing is, this point on regional migration approaches is needed, because, you know, if you're looking at the arrival of Venezuelans to the U.S.-Mexico border that you saw in significant numbers this past year, or the prior year of Haitian migrants that were coming up from South America, and same with Venezuelans who were coming up from South America, That has implications not just for the United States, that has implications for Colombia and Panama, because people are crossing into Panama from the Darien Gap and crossing into Panama, and those individuals are crossing through Central America and are crossing into Mexico, which I think has certainly seen this kind of migration as a major priority to manage and address. And then those folks are coming up to the United States. And I think what you started seeing this past year is an effort to really try to do a regional approach on this. In June of last year, there was the Los Angeles Declaration on Migration and Protection, which is was signed by approximately 20 countries, including the United States. And the whole idea is that you need to use a multitude of tools, different pathways and different tools to be able to manage this, and that each country needs to be contributing to the way that it needs to ensure that you're not having these large-scale migration events that can really destabilize the region. And there were some deliverables that were outlined. There were some solid policy proposals outlined for this that I think are a good way of thinking about it. You know, for instance, trying to find ways that if people are seeking protection in the United States, maybe there are other countries that can offer their own systems to be able to assist with that. You know, a lot of these folks who are coming to the United States or going to Mexico, for instance, are just looking for better economic opportunities. So how can the United States, Canada, Costa Rica, Mexico, and other countries in the region use their work programs for migrants, particularly temporary ones, to give these folks a little bit of a chance to work, make some money, come back, and sort of do the circular migration that you've been seeing a little bit with some of our programs here in the United States, the H-2A seasonal agricultural program being one of them. But this is sort of the bottom line really is saying, like, let's use different tools to take pressure off of different borders and people, giving them more legal pathways to do that. So I think that that is really an important step forward because, you know, no one country in the hemisphere should be dealing with this. You need to be working at it collectively. And so I think this foreign policy component is going to be something that's really important to do that. Really, you know, when looking at the United States, you know, I think the fundamental problem is that we are incapable of having a forward-thinking immigration policy. And that doesn't have to just simply do with the border. It has to do with legal migration, folks who are coming into work or reunite with their families. We just don't have an immigration system that can respond quickly. And, you know, the last two major reforms of our immigration system were 1986 and 1990, and you had an additional reform in 1996. But, you know, these are different reforms to different elements of the immigration system. But, you know, think about where technology was, you know, where the home computer was in 1990, and now you have smartphones that are so much more advanced. That computer from 1990 is our immigration system. And I think we need to update it. We need to get past a lot of the partisan politics to really think through how do you have a forward-facing immigration policy that can respond to the different challenges that we have with immigration, not just simply at the border, but, you know, like I said, with other areas of immigrants to the United States. I'm not, you know, I think a split Congress doesn't give me hope that this is going to happen.
Right.
But we need to do something. It's been far too long.
Well, President Joe Biden this past Thursday unveiled this new policy that you're talking about that will accept 30,000 migrants a month. Some people took a deep breath and had to exhale on that because they feel as though, many that I've talked to, 30,000 migrants is big. That is a lot per month, don't you think?
Not really. If you're considering the number of individuals who are actually arriving at the U.S.-Mexico border in, you know, significant numbers, this is a drop in the bucket. And I think what's important is 30,000 is the number, but what's key is this pathway. The people who can come here, Venezuelans, Cubans, Nicaraguan, and Haitians, mm-hmm. need to get a sponsor in the country who can sponsor them, and these individuals need to fly to the United States. So it is 30,000, but the question is, can you get that sponsor? And the other important thing is they're getting humanitarian parole, which is a two-year temporary protection. They're not here permanently. And I think that's also the other important thing is that they're not going to be here indefinitely. And so that is the other key component. What's also important, too, though, is that, you know, on top of this 30,000, Mexico has agreed to take 30,000 individuals expelled under the Title 42 policy that you mentioned in the introduction for these nationalities. That is really important because up until this point, we really couldn't send these folks back because we didn't have diplomatic relationships with these countries. And there's obviously questions about sending people back to a country like Cuba or Nicaragua that are authoritarian regimes. Mexico saying, we're fine with this, send back 30,000 is pretty significant. So, yes, there are 30,000 that are coming through this pathway, but the question is how many people are going to be able to, you know, fulfill the requirements to come here, and at the same time, that 30,000 number is also, you know, you're going to be sending those back to Mexico. So that's the key component where this policy, you kind of alluded to this in the beginning, doesn't quite satisfy both sides of the debate. It kind of does, it's trying to do two things at the same time, and they describe it as stick and carrot, to have a little bit more of a legal pathway so people aren't coming to the border. But folks who are coming to the border will be expelled to Mexico in those numbers. And it is worth noting that Mexican President López Obrador agreed or is at least more open to receiving more individuals expelled under Title 42. So there might be a lot more individuals that the United States might be able to send back to Mexico.
Okay, so tell me how the Department of Homeland Security and Justice, I know they released some details recently of a plan to impose a new regulation. Now, you and I know that a lot of times you start planning things like that, and it takes a long time. And, of course, Biden, whom I support, he said recently to the people who want to come to this country, please do not just show up at the border. Stay where you are and apply legally from there. And, of course, when you say legally, what's happening here in our country, in our system, it's really tough to get it done.
It is really, really difficult. I think that this is one of those things. Our legal migration system is reformed. I mentioned that, these different series of reforms. The major reforms to our legal migration system were done in 1990. And they really have not had any major updates at all since that time. So if you think about people who want to come here, reunite with their families. Well, the family-based immigration system hasn't changed since 1990. People want to work here. We do have the H-2 programs that have been a key way for some individuals to come work here, particularly Mexicans. It's one of the reasons why you saw a decrease in Mexican migration through the border between 2001 and 2011 because of the H-2A program that I mentioned. But the thing is that system is severely outdated, and one of the reasons it's severely outdated is that you need a lot to come here legally. You need a sponsor for these different pathways where you're coming on a temporary basis or a permanent basis. And that makes it really hard, and the process just can take years and years, particularly if you're looking at the green card system. So, I think that when President Biden said, stay where you are and apply legally, if you're coming through the proper legal migration system, it's really difficult. So in some senses, the policy that he announced tries to create some of these legal pathways using the humanitarian parole program. And I think that that is something that is worth lauding because, myself and some other people who sort of think in my school of thought and immigration policy is that you need different legal pathways that can give viable opportunities for people to come here through legal routes, through regularized routes, and come here. But you need to have them and make them viable because if folks don't think of a route as viable and they're in a pretty tough situation, they look at the situation saying, maybe I just need to get out of here and because I have human rights concerns or economically I'm just not doing well, I need to leave. And there's no viable pathway they're going to try to come here regularly. And, I think what you're seeing with Venezuelan migrants and Haitian migrants in 2022, but the thing is, the key issue is that those folks are coming from South America and cross the Darien Gap, which is probably some of the most treacherous territory you'll find on this planet. They were willing to cross the Darien Gap to reach the U.S.-Mexico border. So that, I think, speaks to the desperation that people can feel. Now, whether or not you think they should be allowed in or you should have these pathways, that's a whole debate. But at the end of the day, people certainly do feel desperation. And if you don't have a viable legal route for them to come here, they're just going to find ways to come here irregularly. And so I think this idea of viable legal pathways is an important part of managing the border.
Well, I really believe that the Democrats have been here in our country has really been working so hard trying to figure out a way to make this happen. And when you use words like humanitarian parole to eligible migrants, immediately I go, what does eligible mean? You know, what does it take to be eligible to get that? And those are so many questions that we have in every country, whether it's Cuba, Haiti, Nicaragua, or Venezuela, are all still very different countries, correct? And their way of doing this is maybe different between all four.
Well, that's where the question comes down to the requirements. So for this specific program, you know, humanitarian parole is a discretionary authority that the Department of Homeland Security can use for different purposes. Humanitarian parole was the key pathway that was used to evacuate Afghans as Afghanistan was collapsing in August of 2021. That was the way to be able to get them out of the country, provide them some temporary protection, and bring them here. Humanitarian parole is the program that was used, you know, when the war in Ukraine broke out. And Ukrainians were coming to the southern border seeking protection. The administration, released the United for Ukraine program, so individuals who can get a sponsor, and that actually is the program that serves as the basis of the one that we're discussing today. People who can get a sponsor, can get vetted, can get screened, can come to the United States for a two-year period. And now we have this current program where, again, who can sponsor you, you have to do proper vetting and screening. But I think humanitarian parole is interesting because it does offer some flexibility in terms of adjusting to the different kinds of migration issues and like I said, the collapse of Afghanistan had nothing to do with our border. That was just simply an emergency situation, and we need to get these folks out and provide them some protection and get them to the United States. So I think that this program this approach is the way forward. It's flexible. It's not perfect.
And I hope that's exactly what it is, because we need to move forward. And I'm so sorry that we are out of time, Cristobal. Cristobal Raymond, migration policy expert, thank you so much for joining us. I need an hour with you. I hope I can make that happen. Take care of yourself. I look forward to talking to you again.
All right. Thank you so much.
All right. All right. Coming up next will be Larry Jacobs, director of the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the University of Minnesota Hubert H. Humphrey School and Department of Political Science. We'll be back. It is now 8:29 here at WCCO as we move forward in this conversation with Larry Jacobs. And it's going to be an interesting one, talking about the Biden documents that have been found at his home and other places. And, you know, even Obama's name came up with some of the documents that he would have had, that sort of thing. It's just all so crazy. I think, Jonathan, that our country is on the brink of breaking, literally breaking, not just in half, but breaking. We thought that was going to happen during the insurrection. And, you know, after that happened, people were thinking, at least the people I know, we were saying, oh my God, this is like the big, huge thing. No, there's constantly big, huge things that are happening in this country. Some we talk about, others we don't talk about. What are you expecting when it comes to talking about Biden with Larry Jacobs?
Well, I know we did this before. We want to try to give equal time on this, and we talked about this with Professor David Schultz. This same topic when it happened to former President Trump and the FBI searching Mar-a-Lago, and mm-hmm. So now the whataboutism is, of course, flying around and everything, and it's this. I think this needs equal time, because now you're talking about not just a former president that's a candidate, but now the sitting president. So, yes, this topic does need to be covered, and it does need to be scrutinized. I think you need to look at the nuance, and I think there are a lot of people that are trying to look at the nuance and a lot of people that aren't trying to look at the nuance. And so I think Professor Jacobs coming on, he can give some perspective to what do we do now in both cases, you know, with President Biden, former President Trump? What do we do? And I don't know. I don't know how it's going to turn out.
All I know is ugly, and there's something very hidden about it, and so it really bothers me. It disturbs me. It disturbs my spirit, and I have a problem with this. It is just constantly going on. It never stops. It never gets better. It's just constantly getting worse,
well,
and I don't understand that.
Well, let me say this. I think overall, I think there is a blame to go to the overall electorate because we have elected and keep electing certain people into places of power where maybe they shouldn't be. And that's something that some in our psyche needs to change to try to say, okay, who really deserves the position of power to lead the country?
So what does that change look like, smell like, and when does it begin? Who's going to head that? Who's going to lead the way? If you're going after the former president and you're also going after the current president, where does it stop?
Your guess is as good as mine.
Okay,
again, I think it's something where it's you've heard of that phrase, systematic problem. I think this might be a bit of a systematic problem, not necessarily in the process that we elect people or we get people into positions where they lead, but finding and recognizing and defining who is going to be that person to lead us. I think that's a problem right now.
So many Americans don't trust any leadership. Period. None. None at all. They don't trust any of the politicians. I mean, it's just ugly. It's really ugly. And I don't know where we go next. How do we heal from this? I'm hoping that Larry Jacobs can give us some insight on what he is seeing, what he is hearing, and he can maybe answer that question in some way. Stay tuned, everyone. Welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. And as many of you have already heard, Larry Jacobs is joining us tonight. Who is he? He's the director of the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the University of Minnesota Hubert H. Humphrey School and Department of Political Science. He is joining us to talk about this. In August, the FBI's search of the Mar-a-Lago Club for classified documents made national headlines. And at the time, everyone talked about what former President Trump's possession of the documents meant for national security and trust. Now, those same conversations are happening after the story broke this week that President Biden had his own stash of classified documents from when he was vice president, discovered at multiple locations, in fact, including his Delaware residence. And after these two instances and the concerns surrounding them, are they really the same? And what does this mean for the current president? To discuss these questions, we asked Larry Jacobs to join the conversation. Again, he is the director of the U of M's Center for the Study of Politics and Governance, and we appreciate him joining us on the John Schuster Caldwell Banker Hotline. How are you, sir?
Good. Good to be with you again.
It's good to be with you again. This is deep to me, okay? I don't know how we're going to get past this because we are so divided here in our country. So let's begin with that. We have a former president and we have a current president, and we're looking at the same type of documents almost, right? And I'm just curious to know, when you first thought about this, what did you think?
Well, obviously, I describe it as an inconvenient truth. We don't actually know if they're the same documents. So far, what we appear to be looking at with Joe Biden are briefing memos. This would be something like an aide would put together information for Vice President Biden. This was back when the Obama administration was in office, mm-hmm. who would give him a briefing on a world leader he was going to meet with. With Donald Trump, we're looking at the most classified documents having to do with the nuclear capacities of other countries, the nature of our weapon systems, the nature of our intelligence gathering. I mean, it is the most highly guarded documents. They're so important that they're actually numbered. So we're sure that only the people who are in a small group of maybe a dozen people are getting them. So they're very different documents. They're not the same, at least so far. And I want to emphasize that because I think we're in an early stage. And the other part, of course, is that Donald Trump had over 300 documents. And Joe Biden, so far, it looks like it's about two dozen.
Yeah, it's very, very I remember hearing about that.
And it's so far.
It sure doesn't sound like it's very different. It sounds as though President Biden is in trouble and Trump, former President Trump, is in trouble. And all of a sudden, it sounds like the same thing. So what we say has a lot of power, right? And I'm just curious to know what happens now, now that we know how many documents there are so far for Biden, and we already know how many documents there were for Trump. I don't know where we go from here. Take us on the, take us to the next movement where you see it's going to happen. And you say, okay, this is the next thing we need to do, and that will lead to what?
So what's happening now is an independent prosecutor. This was a prosecutor who worked during the Trump administration.
Yes.
Has been charged with conducting an investigation. And the first part of that investigation is to document and catalog all the classified documents that Joe Biden had in his house, in his garage, or in one or two offices. And so that's step one, is what are we talking about? Because at this point, I think a lot of us are, you know, grasping, both those who are, you know, see this as hypocrisy, and frankly, folks like me who so far don't see a comparison. Then we're going to get into the second stage, which will be a determination by the special prosecutors to whether laws were broken. And that is going on with Donald Trump right now with regards to his documents. There's a special prosecutor, and they're going to be making the determination whether Donald Trump broke the law in the way he handled those documents.
Okay, so to me, as soon as we knew that President Trump actually had documents, I mean, we could see them, they said classified on them, immediately I thought, okay, so this is going to move along pretty quickly. And it hasn't to me. It hasn't. And my fear, sir, is that Americans are no longer invested. They don't want to hear it. They don't want to know about it. You all go deal with it. Let the legal departments take care of it all. I want to know what we should do about it as, you know, as the community of people who vote that really care about something like this. What can we do to help bring all of this to fruition, to help understand exactly what's happening, why it's happening, and when will it stop?
Well, those are great questions. I think step one is to be informed about this. As I said, I don't see these situations as comparable because of the number of documents, because of the security classification that they're stamped with, and frankly, because the way in which they were handled. As soon as Joe Biden's staff realized that there were some documents that were classified, they were immediately turned over to the Justice Department. There was no delay in terms of the handling of those documents. With Donald Trump, we had, you know, a year and a half and multiple backs and forths, and it's possible that some of Donald Trump's lawyers are going to be facing punishment because they misled the Justice Department as to the number and classification of these documents. And in the legal world, that's known as malicious intent. And that'll be part of what the special prosecutor. Now, let me just step back and say this. And I realize this may not satisfy a lot of people, but when you have a president and a vice president leaving office, it is a fast and chaotic process. They are in charge of running the government until 11:59, and then the new team comes in. And in that process, it is a very quick movement of documents. They're literally put in boxes and moved out.
Larry Jacobs.
Well, I know we did this before. We want to try to give equal time on this, and we talked about this with Professor David Schultz, this same topic, when it happened to former President Trump and the FBI searching Mar-a-Lago. And so now the whataboutism is, of course, flying around and everything. And it's this – I think this needs equal time because now you're talking about not just a former president that's a candidate, but now the sitting president. So, yes, this topic does need to be covered and it does need to be scrutinized. I think you need to look at the nuance, and I think there are a lot of people that are trying to look at the nuance and a lot of people that aren't trying to look at the nuance. And so I think Professor Jacobs coming on, he can give some perspective to what do we do now in both cases, you know, with President Biden and former President Trump. What do we do? And I don't know. I don't know how it's going to turn out.
All I know is ugly, and there's something very hidden about it, and so it really bothers me. It disturbs me. It disturbs my spirit, and I have a problem with this. It is just constantly going on. It never stops. It never gets better. It's just constantly getting worse,
well,
and I don't understand that.
Well, let me say this. I think overall, I think there is a blame to go to the overall electorate because we have elected and keep electing certain people into places of power where maybe they shouldn't be. And that's something that some in our psyche needs to change to try to say, okay, who really deserves the position of power to lead the country?
So what does that change look like, smell like, and when does it begin? Who's going to head that? Who's going to lead the way? If you're going after the former president and you're also going after the current president, where does it stop?
Your guess is as good as mine.
Okay,
again, I think it's something where it's you've heard of that phrase, systematic problem. I think this might be a bit of a systematic problem, not necessarily in the process that we elect people or we get people into positions where they lead, but finding and recognizing and defining who is going to be that person to lead us. I think that's a problem right now.
So many Americans don't trust any leadership. Period. None at all. They don't trust any of the politicians. I mean, it's just ugly. It's really ugly. And I don't know where we go next. How do we heal from this? I'm hoping that Larry Jacobs can give us some insight on what he is seeing, what he is hearing, and he can maybe answer that question in some way. Stay tuned, everyone. Welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. And as many of you have already heard, Larry Jacobs is joining us tonight. Who is he? He's the director of the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the University of Minnesota Hubert H. Humphrey School and Department of Political Science. He is joining us to talk about this. In August, the FBI's search of the Mar-a-Lago Club for classified documents made national headlines. And at the time, everyone talked about what former President Trump's possession of the documents meant for national security and trust. Now, those same conversations are happening after the story broke this week that President Biden had his own stash of classified documents from when he was vice president, discovered at multiple locations, in fact, including his Delaware residence. And after these two instances and the concerns surrounding them, are they really the same? And what does this mean for the current president? To discuss these questions, we asked Larry Jacobs to join the conversation. Again, he is the director of the U of M's Center for the Study of Politics and Governance, and we appreciate him joining us on the John Schuster Caldwell Banker Hotline. How are you, sir?
Good. Good to be with you again.
It's good to be with you again. This is deep to me, okay? I don't know how we're going to get past this because we are so divided here in our country. So let's begin with that. We have a former president and we have a current president, and we're looking at the same type of documents almost, right? And I'm just curious to know, when you first thought about this, what did you think?
Well, obviously, I describe it as inconvenient truth. We don't actually know if they're the same documents. So far, what we appear to be looking at with Joe Biden are briefing memos. This would be something like an aide would put together information for Vice President Biden. This was back when the Obama administration was in office, mm-hmm. who would give him a briefing on a world leader he was going to meet with. With Donald Trump, we're looking at the most classified documents having to do with the nuclear capacities of other countries, the nature of our weapon systems, the nature of our intelligence gathering. I mean, it is the most highly guarded documents. They're so important that they're actually numbered. So we're sure that only the people who are in a small group of maybe a dozen people are getting them. So they're very different documents. They're not the same, at least so far. And I want to emphasize that because I think we're in an early stage. But and the other part, of course, is that Donald Trump had over 300 documents. And Joe Biden, so far, it looks like it's about two dozen.
So yeah, very I remember hearing about that.
So far.
It sure doesn't sound like it's very different. It sounds as though President Biden is in trouble and Trump, former President Trump, is in trouble. And all of a sudden, it sounds like the same thing. So what we say has a lot of power, right? And I'm just curious to know what happens now, now that we know how many documents there are so far for Biden, and we already know how many documents there were for Trump. I don't know where we go from here. Take us to the next movement where you see it's going to happen. And you say, okay, this is the next thing we need to do, and that will lead to what?
So what's happening now is an independent prosecutor. This is a prosecutor who worked during the Trump administration.
Yes.
Has been charged with conducting an investigation. And the first part of that investigation is to document and catalog all the classified documents that Joe Biden had in his house, in his garage, or in one or two offices. And so that's step one, is what are we talking about? Because at this point, I think a lot of us are, grasping, both those who are, see this as hypocrisy, and frankly, folks like me who so far don't see a comparison. Then we're going to get into the second stage, which will be a determination by the special prosecutors to whether laws were broken. And that is going on with Donald Trump right now with regards to his documents. There's a special prosecutor, and they're going to be making the determination whether Donald Trump broke the law in the way he handled those documents.
Okay, so to me, as soon as we knew that President Trump actually had documents, I mean, we could see them, they said classified on them, immediately I thought, okay, so this is going to move along pretty quickly. And it hasn't to me. It hasn't. And my fear, sir, is that Americans are no longer invested. They don't want to hear it. They don't want to know about it. You all go deal with it. Let the legal departments take care of it all. I want to know what we should do about it as the community of people who vote that really care about something like this. What can we do to help bring all of this to fruition, to help understand exactly what's happening, why it's happening, and when will it stop?
Well, those are great questions. I think step one is to be informed about this. As I said, I don't see these situations as comparable because of the number of documents, because of the security classification that they're stamped with, and frankly, because the way in which they were handled. As soon as Joe Biden's staff realized that there were some documents that were classified, they were immediately turned over to the Justice Department. There was no delay in terms of the handling of those documents. With Donald Trump, we had a year and a half and multiple backs and forths, and it's possible that some of Donald Trump's lawyers are going to be facing punishment because they misled the Justice Department as to the number and classification of these documents. And in the legal world, that's known as malicious intent. And that'll be part of what the special prosecutor. Now, let me just step back and say this. And I realize this may not satisfy a lot of people, but when you have a president and a vice president leaving office, it is a fast and chaotic process. They are in charge of running the government until 11:59, and then the new team comes in. And in that process, it is a very quick movement of documents. They're literally put in boxes and moved out. And I don't know what happened with Joe Biden, but it's quite possible that one of these boxes was brought to his office. He knew nothing about it. With Donald Trump, we've already heard from some of his aides that the president was directing some of these documents to be saved. Now, last point I'd make is this is not unique to this time period, the mixing of classified and unclassified documents. All presidential records since 1978 are considered public record, public materials. And so we have had a small amount of classified documents get mixed in with documents that will eventually be made available to the public and researchers like me. I've been to a number of presidential archives. So I don't view this necessarily as nefarious or illegal. There are a lot of questions about the way Donald Trump handled it, but you can go back in time and I think you'd find other presidents had a small number of, you know, not terribly important classified documents like briefing papers that were mixed in this rush to vacate the White House or the vice president's offices.
You know, I have been asking and having conversations with people that I know and trust, and they're saying, hey, these documents must have been placed in these areas. They must have been at Biden's home and all of those places. They're saying these documents are showing up all of a sudden. They're saying, no, 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 somebody else placed them there. When you hear that, what do you say to America? What do you say to Americans who really, truly believe that?
It's hard. I mean, what we know so far, and again, we need an independent investigation, is that these were documents that Joe Biden's staff, and then when he left office, the staff he had then, were handling. There's no evidence so far that Joe Biden even knew about these documents until quite recently when they were brought to his attention. And he said, for goodness sakes, you know, to hand them over. You know, it's obviously, as you said, an embarrassment. And something that is going to be seen as, you know, all politicians do this. I think they're very different cases. You know, I could, you know, here's an historic example. Before 1978, presidents took their private papers with them, including the confidential ones and the classified ones. For Lyndon Johnson, he was terribly embarrassed about the way he'd handled the Vietnam War, and so he just took the incriminating documents with him when he left and took him to his ranch down in Texas. And it was only with 1978, there was a law passed that said, no, the papers that presidents produce while in office actually belongs to the public. And we still don't have a great process, frankly, for making sure that documents that are classified end up with the National Archives system and not, you know, whether by accident or deliberate, end up somewhere else.
End up somewhere else. That's amazing. I'm so glad that you told the story of what has happened before, because we don't necessarily know all of that. I have a book about the Civil War, and I remember reading it thinking, my gosh, this is so much information. There's so much information we don't know, just as the citizens of this country. And it keeps changing. The laws change. We change. Our leaders change. And it's really frustrating, sir. And I know you've heard that from other people. Yet I keep saying to myself, when are we going to get to the point where all of this is finally going to stop and we can go forward as a country? So what is the next step?
Well, I would like to see an impartial set of hearings in Congress that examines how the classified documents are treated at the end of a presidency. And I think we've seen with both Donald Trump and Joe Biden cases where those documents were not treated appropriately. And let me just emphasize, some of these documents, particularly the one that Donald Trump had in his possession, are very important to our future. I mean, they're about our safety. It's about, you know, how do we defend our country? Those are the kind of documents, some of which Donald Trump had in his possession at his Mar-a-Lago retreat. So all this needs to be investigated, and I would like to see Congress update that 1978 law to make it more formal and more rigorous that the classified material is boxed up by the National Archives and stored in a secure facility.
secure facility. I don't even know what that means anymore, considering where we're finding different documents. It really is quite remarkable what is happening in our country. And I must say, sir, having you to talk about this tonight, I really appreciate it. Last question for you. As you move forward and investigating and in your own way, reading as much as possible, hearing as much as possible, and giving out the information to those of us that really don't understand and don't know it, I just want to say thank you for that, first of all. Second of all, I want to say that we need more civic classes to really deal with some of the things that are happening today. What I learned in civics in the 10th, 11th, and 12th grade is not what I'm seeing today. It's so different. And I'm wondering if you agree with that, that we have changed so many of our laws, changed the way we handle things, that it doesn't even feel like the same country to me.
Well, I definitely agree with you about civic education. And a lot of those classes were phased out because, you know, people wanted enrichment classes in the arts, and people wanted, you know, more classes in science and math, you know, all of which are compelling arguments. But understanding how our government works is also compelling. And I think maybe the best example of that is some of the confusion over how our elections work. And I'd like to see, you know, part of that civics education explaining what an election means, who can run, how the ballots are counted, the multiple checks on the ballots that are cast to make sure that the process has integrity. And these things are not secret. It's part of that, you know, one of those worlds that's not known publicly, but exists and is very rigorous, and it's run by, I think, very honorable patriots.
Well, Larry Jacobs, Director of the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance, we really appreciate you joining us tonight and having you on the John Schuster Coldwell Banker Hotline. Thank you, thank you, and I hope we can reach out to you again.
Always. Pleasure to talk.
You too, sir. Take care.
Okay.
All right, everyone, we're going to take a break and come back and wrap it up in just a moment. Welcome back, everyone. My goodness, as we keep looking and trying to find out as much information as possible about what's happening with our President Biden and what's happening even with the former President Trump. Here's the thing. Of course, his press secretary came forward and said, look, the bottom line is that our president did not know that these records were even there in his garage. And she went on to say that, you know, he's doing everything by the book. And it's frustrating to me because then you have all of a sudden the new House Speaker, Kevin McCarthy, comes on and says, well, you know, another faux pas by the Biden administration. Congress has to investigate this. It just blows my mind as though nothing they touch stinks. You know, it's just ridiculous to me, Jonathan. And I know you probably are thinking a whole different way than I am, but it is crazy. Easy for me.
This is what I was talking about earlier when I said the process that we have for putting people in power may be a good process, may be a decent process, but we're not vetting the people that we put in power well enough. And we're not vetting what they do when they get to power. Because, case in mind, George Santos.
Oh gosh, let's not talk about him.
I'm just saying,
go to sleep tonight.
Right now, I know there are other examples of it, but he right now is the poster child for us not doing a good job vetting our candidates and putting them into office.
Whole different conversation. Oh, my gosh.
I think, Jonathan. I think a lot of it starts there, though. I really do.
Yeah. Well, coming up next is Center Stage, All Things Arts and Entertainment. We just believe you ought to know about it. We'll be back.
That the president was directing some of these documents to be saved. Now, last point I'd make is this is not unique to this time period, the mixing of classified and unclassified documents. All presidential records since 1978 are considered public record, public materials. And so we have had a small amount of classified documents get mixed in with documents that will eventually be made available to the public and researchers like me. I've been to a number of presidential archives. So I don't view this necessarily as nefarious or illegal. There are a lot of questions about the way Donald Trump handled it, but you can go back in time, and I think you'd find other presidents have had a small number of, you know, not terribly important classified documents like briefing papers that were mixed in this rush to vacate the White House or the vice president's offices.
You know, I have been asking and having conversations with people that I know and trust, and they're saying, hey, these documents must have been placed in these areas. They must have been at Biden's home and all of those places. They're saying these documents are showing up all of a sudden. They're saying, no, somebody else placed them there. When you hear that, what do you say to America? What do you say to Americans who really, truly believe that?
It's hard. I mean, what we know so far, and again, we need an independent investigation, is that these were documents that Joe Biden's staff, and then when he left office, the staff he had then, were handling. There's no evidence so far that Joe Biden even knew about these documents until quite recently, when they were brought to his attention, and he said, for goodness sakes, you know, to hand them over. You know, it's obviously, as you said, an embarrassment. And something that is going to be seen as, you know, all politicians do this. I think they're very different cases. You know, here's an historic example. Before 1978, presidents took their private papers with them, including the confidential ones and the classified ones. For Lyndon Johnson, he was terribly embarrassed about the way he'd handled the Vietnam War, and so he just took the incriminating documents with him when he left and took him to his ranch down in Texas. And it was only with 1978, there was a law passed that said, no, the papers that presidents produce while in office actually belongs to the public. And we still don't have a great process, frankly, for making sure that documents that are classified end up with the National Archive system and not, you know, whether by accident or deliberate, end up somewhere else.
End up somewhere else. That's amazing. I'm so glad that you told the story of what has happened before, because we don't necessarily know all of that. I have a book about the Civil War, and I remember reading it thinking, my gosh, this is so much information. There's so much information we don't know, just as the citizens of this country. And it keeps changing. The laws change. We change. Our leaders change. And it's really frustrating, sir. And I know you've heard that from other people. Yet I keep saying to myself, when are we going to get to the point where all of this is finally going to stop and we can go forward as a country? So what is the next step?
Well, I would like to see an impartial set of hearings in Congress that examines how the classified documents are treated at the end of a presidency. And I think we've seen with both Donald Trump and Joe Biden, cases where those documents were not treated appropriately. And let me just emphasize, some of these documents, particularly the one that Donald Trump had in his possession, are very important to our future. I mean, they're about our safety. It's about, you know, how do we defend our country? Those are the kind of documents, some of which Donald Trump had in his possession at his Mar-a-Lago retreat. So all this needs to be investigated, and I would like to see Congress update that 1978 law to make it more formal and more rigorous that the classified material is boxed up by the National Archives and stored in a secure facility.
Secure facility. I don't even know what that means anymore, considering where we're finding different documents. It really is quite remarkable what is happening in our country. And I must say, sir, having you to talk about this tonight, I really appreciate it. Last question for you. As you move forward and investigating and in your own way, reading as much as possible, hearing as much as possible, and giving out the information to those of us that really don't understand and don't know it, I just want to say thank you for that, first of all. Second, second of all, I want to say that we need more civic classes to really deal with some of the things that are happening today. What I learned in civics in the 10th, 11th, and 12th grade is not what I'm seeing today. It's so different. And I'm wondering if you agree with that, that we have changed so many of our laws, changed the way we handle things, that it doesn't even feel like the same country to me.
Well, I definitely agree with you about civic education. A lot of those classes were phased out because, you know, people wanted enrichment classes in the arts, and people wanted, you know, more classes in science and math, you know, all of which are compelling arguments. But understanding how our government works is also compelling. And I think maybe the best example of that is some of the confusion over how our elections work. And I'd like to see, you know, part of that civics education explaining what an election means, who can run, how the ballots are counted, the multiple checks on the ballots that are cast to make sure that the process has integrity. And these things are not secret. It's part of that, you know, one of those worlds that's not known publicly, but exists and is very rigorous. And it's run by, I think, very honorable patriots.
Well, Larry Jacobs, Director of the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance, we really appreciate you joining us tonight and having you on the John Schuster Coldwell Banker Hotline. Thank you, thank you, and I hope we can reach out to you again.
Always. Pleasure to talk.
You too, sir. Take care.
Okay.
All right, everyone, we're going to take a break and come back and wrap it up in just a moment. Welcome back, everyone. My goodness, as we keep looking and trying to find out as much information as possible about what's happening with our President Biden and what's happening even with the former President Trump. Here's the thing. Of course, his press secretary came forward and said, look, the bottom line is that our president did not know that these records were even there in his garage. And she went on to say that, you know, he's doing everything by the book. And it's frustrating to me because then you have all of a sudden the new House Speaker, Kevin McCarthy, comes on and says, well, you know, another faux pas by the Biden administration. Congress has to investigate this. It just blows my mind as though nothing they touch stinks. You know, it's just ridiculous to me, Jonathan. And I know you probably are thinking a whole different way than I am, but it is crazy. For me,
this is what I was talking about earlier when I said the process that we have for putting people in power may be a good process, may be a decent process, but we're not vetting the people that we put in power well enough, and we're not vetting what they do when they get to power. Because, case in mind, George Santos.
Oh gosh, let's not talk about him.
I'm just saying, this
is tonight.
Right now, I know there are other examples of it, but he right now is the poster child for us not doing a good job vetting our candidates and putting them into office.
That is a whole different conversation. Oh, my gosh. Thank you, Jonathan.
I think a lot of it starts there, though. I really do.
Yeah. Well, coming up next is Center Stage, All Things Arts and Entertainment. We just believe you ought to know about it. We'll be back.